Now the question is asked, it was asked when Marx wrote, and is still being asked, why can't it be arranged so that production goods industries and the consumer goods industries and all their subdivisions, why can't it be arranged that they all expand and keep in balance with each other? One reason is that the actual conditions that exist when a depression is beginning to expand. If you look at the middle of a depression, I mean, suppose you take the present situation in this country and imagine that perhaps in some months' time capitalism will start expanding again. Well, at this present moment, there are 1.5 million unemployed workers, there's lots of idle machinery, lots of factory space not being used. So when the capitalists start expanding, particularly consumer industries in this country, they can do so by using all the existing factory space and machinery. They won't have to invest more, getting more machinery from the production goods industry. So that will go ahead, and the production goods industries will be lagging behind, because at that point, not very many capitalists want to buy anything from them in the way of more machinery and more factory space. So in that first phase of expansion, the expansion of production goes on and the production goods industries are left behind. Now there comes a later stage, if the expansion goes on, when the consumer goods industries will be going to the production goods industries and saying that we want more factory space, we want more factories, we want more machinery and all the rest of it. And then you'll get a stage in each phase when both industries are, like the consumer goods industries and the production goods industries, are both moving together and competing with each other. And then you get the situation, as existed in 1973, when you've got lots of the British capitalists in 1970, more than half of them, were saying that they had more orders than they could fill. They couldn't fill them because they couldn't get enough steel, they couldn't get enough components, they couldn't get all sorts of things necessary for production. Now, the other disproportion Marx dealt with was what he called disproportion of the consumption of the capitalists and the accumulation of their capital. When there is overproduction for particular markets, in either of the production goods industries or the consumer goods industries, some surplus value that the capitalists have had produced for them for the workers is in the form of commodities, and this is of no use to the capitalist, he's got to turn it into money. But if it happens, you see, that he's got some of his surplus value and can't turn it into money because of market conditions have been adverse, then the capitalist can't reproduce and accumulate their capital. This is what Marx had in mind. When this happens, capitalists sack some of their workers and stop investment plans, and you will notice Marx's wording, he talked about the non-producing classes. What Marx had in mind particularly then, and it is no longer true now, at the time Marx wrote, there was an enormous army of women and men, domestic servants and flunkies. And what Marx pointed out was, at the point where the capitalists can't turn their surplus value into money, I mean, they're running into difficulty, he said the first thing they do, they cut their luxury expenditure, and in particular, they cut that particular form of luxury expenditure was the employment of this huge army of women and men, domestic servants, they're thrown on the labour market. Well, that is no longer true because this great army of domestic servants doesn't exist. But it is still true, of course, that when the capitalist runs into difficulties, he does cut down his luxury expenditure, and he does sack workers. Another very important factor Marx said has to be taken into account. Because the capitalists are competing with each other for the market, they're always trying to accumulate more and more capital. For example, by installing costly labour-saving machinery which will enable them to sell more cheaply. In other words, every capitalist, unless he wants to go under, is trying to become bigger. He's trying to enlarge the scale of his production, for the very good reason that the larger the scale of production, the smaller the unit cost of the thing he's going to sell. Now, what Marx pointed out was that in the early days of capitalism, capitalists in the main produced for a demand in the market. But as capitalism developed, he said the capitalists are less and less producing in response to demand for product, and more increasing the scale of production as an end in itself. And that is, of course, true of capitalism generally. You either get larger or you fall back and you go under. And as has been shown in every period of expansion and boom in capitalism's history, disproportion has in fact produced crisis, and as Marx said, you can take it that this is inevitable. They certainly have neither in Marx's time nor since have they found any way of getting out of this dilemma that they're in. One thing that to notice is that you do not in a boom have all industries overproducing for their particular market. I've mentioned this already. The crisis is sparked off when a sufficient number of capitalists overproduce. In 1973, it was the motor cars, shipbuilding, and steel that sort of were in trouble first. At the height of the boom in the autumn of 1973, in the inquiry which is conducted periodically by the Financial Times, they brought this out in some figures they got. In the autumn of 1973, only 19% of companies reported that they were holding down production because they were short of orders. Over half the companies reported that they had more orders than they could meet, but they couldn't get the raw materials and the steel and the aluminium and the electrical components and plastics. Also, some of them were short of oil. You will also notice that overproduction, that is not another way of saying disproportion, or rather disproportion is not another way of saying overproduction. From the standpoint of the companies, which in the autumn of 1973 could not meet their orders because they were short of steel and other things, they would look at it and they say, look, the steel industry is too small, it ought to be larger. From the point of view of the steel industry would say, look, we're too large. But it simply depends on the way you look at it. Marx used disproportion because it covers both aspects. From the point of view of one lot of capitalists, the others haven't developed enough. And from the point of view of the other capitalists, the others have developed too much, as it were. That is, they're both of them aspects of disproportion. Now, you notice, in the autumn of 1973, you had over 50% of the companies saying they had more orders than they could meet. And they were short of steel and they were short of components. When the crisis happened, when some of the industries overproduced, start cutting back production, sacking workers, stop buying machinery and things like this, then you have a crisis. Immediately, everything goes into reverse. The steel industry, which appeared to be too small in the autumn of 1973, 6 months later, or even 3 or 4 months later, suddenly appears to be too large. There is now no shortage of workers, because you've got hundreds of thousands out of work. There is no shortage of materials. Everything is quite different. You will now see why I insisted at the beginning you want to recognize that a crisis is not a depression. The thing that causes a crisis is quite different from the thing that operates after the crisis has happened and when you are actually in a depression. It's the disproportion which sparks off the crisis. And at that time, during the boom, as Marx pointed out, wages are rising and the workers at that stage are getting a larger share of the consumer products. And it is in fact not that the workers' income is falling that causes the crisis, it's because the capitalists stop spending money. If you look at the period in the boom, workers' wages are rising and he's getting a larger share of consumer goods. So as Marx said, it can't be the workers' wages which are causing the crisis, but what actually causes the crisis is that the capitalists, at the height of a boom, those who've overproduced for their particular market, suddenly stop spending. Doesn't mean they couldn't go on spending, but they decide not to, because they're not going to make a profit by additional investment and additional production. Once the crisis has happened and the depression begins, then the thing can spiral downwards. You see that the capitalists who are first to be in trouble, those in the motor industry, they stop producing cars, they stop buying steel, they stop buying components, then those workers are put out of work, then those workers can't buy as much consumer goods, and the thing can spread quite a long way, and of course it can last quite a long time. Well, it's also, by the way, worth remembering that even in the depths of a depression, you will always find some industries doing very well. Just at the moment, you'll notice the oil companies getting peak profits and, incidentally, the banks. And a few other industries, even at this present time, are doing very well and are expanding. Some economists who accepted Marx's view at the time did raise this question as to why couldn't disproportion be avoided. Once you knew that it was disproportion that caused the crisis, why couldn't some arrangements be made to get rid of it? And one idea they had, Bernstein had it, and I rather think Kautsky does, although writing about it later on, he sort of puts the blame on other people. One idea they had was, at the end of the 19th century, around 1900, a lot of international trusts and cartels would be formed. And the idea was put forward, and if you had all the world's industries controlled by trusts and cartels, they would get together and they would be able to iron out all this disproportion, and then you'd have continuous prosperity, capitalism expanding and expanding and never having any setback. Well, the first thing to notice, of course, is that unless these trusts and cartels have government backing to do whatever they may want to do, they have no capacity to do this. The trusts and cartels and the modern multinational companies can't determine what is produced, where it's produced, how much is produced, and all the rest of it. They could only do this if they had government backing. And in any event, of course, the trusts and cartels, generally speaking, have a comparatively short life. They provoke opposition to themselves. So another suggestion made by these people about ironing out disproportion was, well, if the trusts couldn't do it, governments could do it. This is the Labour Party idea. The Labour Party has grown up in the last 30 or 40 years on the idea of planning. And they would say the government will plan this thing to see that industries all keep in harmony. And you had, of course, that great fiasco of the Labour government, their national plan in 1964. And they thought they were planning this. And all they were in fact doing, they were just drawing up a lot of suggestions for industry, which had no real relation to what companies actually had to do. One of the things that followed after this, and the Tories were just as much as the Labour Party, they planned to expand the steel industry. In other words, they had observed on previous occasions that at certain periods there appears to be a shortage of steel, and so they said, well, look, we'll plan for an increased production of steel. And they in fact planned for the doubling of the capacity of the steel industry. And you notice what they are now doing is, having planned to double it, they are now planning to cut it back to half or even less than half again. So in any event, even if you think of government planning, again it's meaningless unless all the governments do it. The British government can't plan what's going to be the world market for cars, or the world market for steel, or oil, or anything else. It could only be done if the capitalist governments of the world all agree to do it. And of course, they have no intention or wish to do it. They have their own kind of priorities. The fact, for example, that at the present time, in the industrialized countries, there is an overcapacity in textiles, steel, shipbuilding, and motor cars, doesn't prevent a whole range of other governments in the world who are themselves deliberately at this moment expanding their capacity to produce textiles, steel, motor cars, and shipbuilding. In other words, they're doing it for political and military reasons. And they're quite uninterested. If the British capitalists would say to them, look, you don't need to build more shipyards and more steelworks and various parts of the world, we can supply you with steel. Their answer is that they prefer to have it of both for political and military reasons inside their own boundaries, and they would go on doing it. One economist, writing in Lloyds Bank Review a couple of years ago, went into this business and suggested a solution of his own. What he said was, since this disproportion does happen, since consumer industries expand and the expansion of the production goods industries lags behind, What the government needs to do is to prevent the consumer industries expanding so quickly, give the production goods industries time to catch up, and then you wouldn't get bottlenecks, as in fact you do get in a boom when you get people unable to produce because they can't get materials. I would say that it's a complete non-starter for two reasons. Imagine a British government at a time when, say, there was a booming market for motor cars or for steel or for textiles or anything else. Imagine a British government going to the British capitalists and, incidentally, the British trade union and saying, look, we're going to hold back this production. We know you've got what appears to be a very large and profitable market for your products. We're not going to let you take advantage of it. We're going to hold you back and give some other industries, the production goods industries, time to catch up. If the government, I mean, for political reasons, it's quite obvious they couldn't do it, but if they did, it would they would immediately have it pointed out to them by the industries in question, look, if there is a great demand for motor cars at the present time, and we could sell British cars in this market, and you tell us not to, you tell us to hold it back, all that will happen is that foreign capitalists will push these things into the British market, and we'll lose the market permanently. We won't catch it, get it back afterwards. So I would say that though the idea may look all right on paper, it is in fact a non-starter. There is another popular misconception about what causes booms and depressions. It is that they're determined by armament expenditure. The people who hold this view say that if armament expenditure is increased, you get a boom. If armament expenditure is cut, you get a depression. To start with, by the way, it assumes that there is something different in producing armaments from producing any other commodity. And of course there isn't, except the one that in the main the armaments are bought by government, otherwise it's just like anything else. And they also, by the way, don't notice, or it's worth noticing, that a very large part of what the government calls defence expenditure isn't on weapons. It's on the uniforms, the food, the housing, and the transport of the people in the armed forces. It doesn't matter to a clothing manufacturer whether he's making uniforms for soldiers, sailors, and airmen, or whether he's making uniforms for postmen, busmen, and railwaymen. I mean, from a capitalist point of view, it's exactly the same kind of thing. So when you actually look at what has happened, you'll see that the argument will not hold water. After World War II, all the governments involved in the war reduced their armament expenditure enormously. According to the theory, they ought to have produced an enormous army of unemployed. In this country, for example, in the year 1944-5, defence expenditure was 4,410 million, and unemployment at that time was 1.2%. By 1951, defence expenditure in this country had been cut by three quarters, down to 1,100 million, but unemployment was still 1.2%. All it meant was capitalism was going through a boom, and when capitalism is going through a boom, it doesn't make any difference whether part of it is armament expenditure or whether part isn't, or whether the thing is rising or falling. Or take an increase of armament expenditure. Between 1948 and 52, armament expenditure in this country was doubled from 770 to 1,400 million. But unemployment in 1952 was actually rather less than it had been in 1948. I don't need to, I mean, you could find many other examples. The simple fact is that capitalism goes through its booms, its crises, its depressions, irrespective of whether armament expenditure is high or low, or is rising or falling. I now want to say something about Louis Boudin, whose theoretical system of Karl Marx is otherwise quite a good one, that Boudin went wrong on this business of crises and depressions. He argued, incidentally, that he was putting Marx's view, but he wasn't really. I mean, where Marx spoke about certain tendencies operating, Boudin treated them as if Marx was saying this must happen. Boudin argued that the proportion of the national income going to the working class must go on falling, and that the proportion going to surplus value must go on rising. Therefore, said Boudin, unemployment must continually get more and more, wages must be driven down nearer and nearer to subsistence level, surplus value becomes larger and larger and the workers can't buy it, so capitalism will be in a permanent depression and getting worse and worse. Now, all of Buddha's assumptions have proved to be wrong. Unemployment has not gone on getting larger and larger. It goes up and down, as it always does in depressions and booms. Depression has not become permanent. I mean, Buddha was writing this in 1907, and there have been several quite normal booms since Buddha wrote. The share of the workers in the national income has not fallen, but has risen. Buddha didn't notice, I mean, there's no reason why he should have done, a factor that has operated, well, I've mentioned before, that you have, unlike the 19th century, you now have an enormous army of bureaucrats, civil servants and local government staff, who've got to be paid wages, which in effect come out of surplus value. And the result has been that, as compared with Marx's day, the working class get a larger share of total national income, the whole working class, that is, than they did at that time. Marx didn't really hold this view. As Marx put, even in a simple summary like value, price and profit, Marx said that the way the product is divided between workers and work capitalists, between wages and profit, depends on the strength of the contending parties. And incidentally, of course, one of the changes that's taking place is that the trade unions are able to be more effective now than they were in the early days of capitalism. I also referred on a previous occasion, dealing with productivity, to the fact that, starting with Adam Smith, all the subsequent economists, or nearly all of them, have enormously exaggerated the rate at which workers' output increases. And this, of course, has distorted their view of what causes a crisis and what operates in a depression. Buddha enormously exaggerated. But you can say that all of them did. The people I've mentioned, John Gray, Major Douglas, Kautsky, Engels, Buddin, and a whole lot of other people, including, of course, Feynman and the old Social Democratic Federation, John Strachey in his book that I've already referred to, and I'll say something about that again, and that recent book by Clive Jenkins and Sherman on the collapse of work. They make exactly the same error that Adam Smith and the others have made in calculating the increase in productivity. Even Marx did it, although not nearly to such an extent as Engels and others. Marx talked about an enormous increase in productivity, and in the years when Marx was writing Capital, that's in the 60s, 70s of the 19th century, the actual annual increase of output of the whole British working class was under 2% a year. Now, if it had been, say, 20% a year, you can see it would present an entirely different sort of problem. Strachey, by the way, worked out his theory that capitalism was in a state of imminent collapse. He based them on the Austin Motor Company, and he then said that this applies throughout industry everywhere. They're all increasing at the same rate. And he, on the basis of these figures, he showed, or thought that he showed, that the output of the workers generally in this country was increasing at 20% a year. Well, the actual increase was under 1% a year for those years that he chose. They were the years in the 20s and early 30s. In the 1920s. The simple fact was that Kautsky, that Strachey, like Adam Smith and the others, did not understand how to calculate productivity. They all made this sort of mistake. So this is something you've got to bear in mind, that productivity does not increase at these great rates. In the last 20 years in this country, it's been about 2%, and it's possibly likely to be a bit more in the future. One other question to consider: an economist writing in Lloyd's Bank Review in July 1978 did some studies, and he suggested that in post-war years, the pattern is a crisis about every 7 to 11 years, with smaller upsets about every 3.5 years. The longest depression of all, of course, was the Great Depression, 1875 to 95. Nothing before or since has lasted as long as that. But I don't know any economist who, so to speak, has worked out any real useful theory that can enable you to forecast. Mark Twain was found they couldn't forecast, and I don't know anybody else who really can. And it is, so to speak, one of the facts of capitalist life. Capitalists in the main are always being taken by surprise by the crisis when it actually happens. There is one thing interesting to know. I don't suggest that it's worth going into, although it's an interesting sort of thing. There was a Russian economist, Kondratiev, who advanced what is known as the long wave theory. It is that in addition to a cycle of about 10 years or so, that there is also a 50-year upward and downward wave. And he based it on, his explanation was, it depends on some very complicated technical developments. He suggested, for example, that from 1780 to 1820, it was the steam engine that was dominating the situation. From 1844 to 1874, the railway boom, and latterly, the motor car and electricity. Certainly, there does seem to be some sort of wave like this. I mean, if you look at the way depressions have operated, but I don't know any economist who's satisfied with the Kondratiev's explanation. I don't suggest that you need to go into it. After all, 50 years is a long time. And the reason why economists have reawakened their interest in this Russian is that the last 30 years, nearly all the economists have worked on the assumption there wasn't going to be any more depressions ever because of the theories of Keynes. Now they're finding that Keynes doesn't work. They're beginning to look around at other people, including this man. Incidentally, the result of his publishing his work in Russia was that he got sent to Siberia. The last question that this is worth looking at is, how does capitalism recover from a depression? Capitalism gets out of a depression when the capitalist starts expanding production and expanding investment. And they do that, of course, when they see a prospect of making a profit. They don't do it now. I mean, the 1.5 million unemployed now because the capitalists can't make any profit out of them. But a number of factors operate. One of the factors, Marx drew a lot of attention to this repeatedly, was bankruptcies. In the Depression, a lot of firms go bankrupt. Well, it's a waste of capital, but it also gets competitors out of the way. When a capitalist in a particular line of business goes bankrupt, it does help to improve the prospects for the survivors. Unsold stocks that may get run down. At some stage, interest rates may be lower. The real wages of the workers always fall in the depression, which of course helps is one of the factors in enabling the capitalist to see better prospect of making a profit. Because the fact that Marx referred to that in a boom, workers' wages are rising faster than production of consumer goods, has one effect, of course, is that this rise in wages is cutting in the capitalist profit margins. The reverse takes place in the depression when wages come down, which may help to, at some stage, to give the capitalist hope that he's going to make a profit by starting production again. Raw materials frequently drop drastically in the depression. And of course, the other factor, as Marx pointed out, is that new industries come along and some old industries get redeveloped. The silicon chip industries are now expanding fast. And in this country and a number of other countries, of course, the oil industry is absorbing thousands of millions of investment and expending. Coal is re-emerging. A lot of capitalists, including the oil companies, are now investing money in redeveloping coal and opening up coal mines. And there's something like a railway boom in some of the third world countries. And, of course, a lot of development of communications, telephones and so on. I would say you don't need to pay too much attention to the gloomy prophets who tell you, that unemployment's going to be 2 million, 5 million, and the rest of it in a few years. They may be right, they may be wrong, but it's pure guesswork. And remember the speech made by Lord Randolph Churchill in the middle of the Great Depression, 1884, where Randolph Churchill, later as Chancellor of the Exchequer, literally wrote off British industries. He said there was no British industry showing any prospect whatever of survival. He had, in fact, as it were, written off the revival of capitalism. But, of course, capitalism did revive, and had subsequent booms and so on, and more crises. I did refer at the beginning to some changes that have taken place since Marx wrote. They're not very important, but one, I've already mentioned, the enormous rise in the bureaucracy, who of course are a cost that the capitalists have to meet. They've got to pay wages and salaries to them in the cost of administration. Trade unions are more and larger and more effective than they were in the early days of capitalism. And the introduction of unemployment pay and social security has altered one factor. In Marx's day, when a depression came, the workers were suddenly without wages, and they were, most often, literally on the verge of starvation. So you had a very sharp and big drop in total working class income and expenditure. Well, owing to the unemployment pay and social security, the drop takes place now, but it isn't as drastic as it was at the time that Marx wrote. I think that's the end.